This is case number 50740, Arnold Simon Appellant versus Amy McClure Respondent. We have Mr. Marshall S. Willick for the appellant, Mr. Kirby R. Wells for the respondent. And the panel looks very much forward to these fine family lawyers making these arguments. We're excited to have you both here. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Willick.
May it please the court, Justice Cherry, Justice Gibbons, Justice Theta, and it is a pleasure to be here to respond to your first point. We very much appreciate not having to go to Carson City to give this argument. The facts of this case are pretty straightforward, and if the court's fully familiar with them, I'll skip over them. If not, then I'll briefly recite them. The only essential jurisdictional facts is that the child was born in the state of California. Both parties happened to relocate there in 2001, mom from Las Vegas, dad from New Jersey. Arnold returned to New Jersey in 2003. Mother and child left California in 2005 and came to Las Vegas. And the modification motion was filed in 2007, 2 years later. It was served on mom in Las Vegas, and the proceedings have gone from then to now uninterrupted. I think that the primary issue is pretty straightforward.
Now, Ms. McClure lived in Nevada at the time she was served with this back in 2007.
For about 3 years.
Yeah, but she was living here at that time.
At that time. Okay. This was the only place she had a home. This was the only place she had a car. This is where her child was enrolled in school. This is where she apparently had a job. This is home for all every purpose shown by the record. Mr. Simon lived in New Jersey, which made him an out-of-state party seeking modification. And that's how UIFSA works. If everyone leaves the state that originally renders an order, both parties are required to file to play an away game. If she wanted to modify, she would have to chase him in New Jersey. If he wanted to modify, he'd have to chase her in Nevada. No other state anywhere could modify the existing California order. UIFSA was set up that way in 1996 as an accusal. The Conference of Commissioners has made clear there's never been an amendment to that structure. It's always been intended to work that way. The technical wording amendments that went into place in 2001 that this court commented on in the unpublished order 2 years ago in my other case that is now part of the Nevada statute merely clarified that that's always been the law. So,
and Mr. Wilk, I know we have, I think, three main issues here. Also, I'm concerned Judge Delvecchio didn't make any findings and conclusions and all on that, on all these particular issues. You want to address that?
Is that the absence of findings? The only finding that he made was that California was the state of original issuance, and he confused the concept of controlling order, which the California order obviously was, with the concept of modification jurisdiction, which is totally irrelevant to the issue of what state modified it. And I have no explanation for that. It's merely what he said.
Okay.
Frankly, I don't...
What about the retroactivity issue there like that? The retroactivity...
We don't think there is a retroactivity issue. When the accusal clarified, that's used twice in this case, and I'm not sure which piece you're talking about. It's the registration statute, or are you talking
about...
Do
the amendments to the UIFSA apply retroactively?
There have been no amendments to it, only clarifications. And the accusal couldn't have been more clear in stating over and over again, we're not changing anything. We're not changing anything. We're merely clarifying what is true. It's exactly what this court noted in the footnotes in the unpublished order that previously went up, which is why we need a published opinion, because this keeps happening. This is a recurring problem with family courts, where for some reason, despite the clarity of the statutes, some of the judges down there just don't seem to get it. That jurisdiction is established at the moment that a motion is filed, and you can't defeat that jurisdiction by choosing to leave the state thereafter. But twice now, in the last couple of years, I've stood before this court where parties have done exactly that, where they have gotten up in the middle of the case and moved to California and said, I don't have jurisdiction, and for some reason, at least two judges of the 8th Judicial District Court have said, oh, well, okay then, bye. But that's not how it works. If the court had jurisdiction at the moment of filing, the court has jurisdiction to the moment of decision. And your unilateral relocation of the defendant during the middle of the case is irrelevant to the court's jurisdiction and power to dispose of the case, which is really all this case is about. The rest of it is a sideshow. The other retroactivity piece, which is why I asked which piece you were talking about, had to do with the technical correction to the registration statute, which is not technically before this court at all. I merely
right.
said that the
I wasn't talking about that.
Okay.
So what about the registration not done under Chapter 13611 versus what it was done under Chapter 125A? What's your comments on that?
Well, that's the piece I was just talking about. The legislature finally got around to fixing this. The original form of the statute called for the registration.
I realize this was in between. I understand that, but... what's the legal effect of that, though? The fact that it wasn't fixed at the time this occurred?
Oh, it was fixed by the time it went to hearing. By the time of the hearing in October of 2007, the legislative change to the statute to conform with the way we've always done it, which was passed in May, had gone into effect as of October 1. And all that did was say that the spurious language of the statute, talking about a non-existent policy under the State Information Agency, which nobody knows about, nobody can do, because there was no such procedure, meant that people should do what we've always done since 1997, which is file the out-of-state support order with the district court and then move for modification, because there was no other mechanism to do it. The position of my opponent that, well, if the statute had a technical impossibility in it, what that means is nobody can ever register an out-of-state child custody order and you can't modify it, that's just silly. It would be silly public policy. It would be contrary. It would mean that every child support case that this court has heard that came from an out-of-state source, 1997 and now, was invalid. If their position is valid, none of those out-of-state child support orders were ever validly registered in the state of Nevada, and that can't be the case. So the statute should be read to make sense, which would have to be in compliance with the uniform practice of everybody, for the 10 years before the technical amendment saying the way we've always done it is the way you should do it went into effect. And in any event, that has nothing to do with jurisdiction, which is the only issue here. Mm-hmm. And even if it did, it was fixed before the hearing. So it's applicable under the case law that we've set out. And then, of course, there's the matter that there is no cross appeal. And Judge Delvecchio never said anything. All he said is, I don't want to hear about the registration. That's fine. I don't want to hear about it. He never said that there was any problem with the registration. So there was no such finding. That's really about all I have to say. I realize that's pretty simple. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
That'll be the order. You have 7 minutes and 30 seconds left. Mr. Wells, on behalf of the respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. It's always a pleasure to argue these kinds of cases because I think that they're both interesting and they're somewhat technical, and I think that I have a forte in that area, as does Mr. Willick. First of all, let me correct several things that he's just told you, which I think are incorrect. First of all, the district court's ruling was in response to the motion which we filed to dismiss the registration. He granted that motion. So it wasn't that he ignored it or said he didn't want to have anything to do with it. If you read the transcript and the order, which I have right here,
I think we had it, Mr. Wells. We understand it was a dismissal. That was the vehicle to get it up.
And the fact is that while the appellate wants to argue that once a motion is filed that the jurisdictional issue is fixed is simply not correct, because there's a two-step process here as clearly set forth in the statute. It requires, first of all, proper registration. And one thing I really want to correct what Mr. Willick says is that our position is somehow that there's no way to properly register a foreign support order in the state of Nevada for enforcement or modification. It has never been our position. That's silly. What we've always said is that the proper vehicle for modifying a foreign support order is Chapter 130. And in fact, this court said the same thing in this opinion that was appended to the case memo that was filed, although it wasn't cited in the appellant's brief. this unpublished opinion, I guess, of Smith versus Thompson, specifically refers to the registration having taken place under NRS Chapter 130. It doesn't say 125. 125 is a custody enforcement statute. And to this day, the appellant has always taken a position, doesn't make any difference, but he's wrong. It does make a difference because there are significant differences in the way you, the notice requirements under Chapter 130 versus 125, and what the district court's obligation is to do if they're faced with a custody enforcement order versus a support modification order. I almost feel like I'm going to waive this statute. I feel like Joe McCarthy I have in my hand. If you look at the plain language of the statute, and this is the 07 version after modifications, but it doesn't make any difference. It says, Chapter 125A, Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act. It doesn't say anything about support orders. If you look at, I had it marked and I just, hold on. If you look at Chapter 130, it says, Interjurisdictional Support Enforcement Act, Chapter 130, Interjurisdictional Enforcement of Support. And there's a, and there is a specific section of this statute, which is Chapter 130.611, which specifically deals with modification of child support order of another state. How much clearer can this be?
Well, I guess, Mr. Wells, my and I'll assume Mr. Willick's argument for the purpose of this, like, now, it appeared it was filed under the wrong statute. I don't think there's any question
about
that. But if what he filed put your client on notice and it pretty much substantially complied with what had to be done under Chapter or NRS 136.11.
Good question. And
what's the harm? I mean, I'm going back to the district court days. So that's kind of how you look at
stuff. No harm, no foul. Well, frankly, I have two answers to that. First of all, it did make a difference in this case because under the 130, the correct statute, they have to give notice that she has, my client has, or anybody else has 20 days to contest the registration. See, and that's an important notice requirement because if you're going to contest either the validity of the foreign support order or the enforceability of it, you have 20 days to do that before the district court can invoke its jurisdiction and get to the merits of a modification motion. It doesn't make any difference that they can file a motion. It's any time after, I guess, after they file their notice that they want to enforce this foreign order, but the notice says they can't do anything. The court has to give that person, the non-registering party, 20 days to file a protest, okay? And that's exactly what she did. That's exactly what she did. And her notice about the enforceability was two steps. Number one, I'm not a resident. And number two, you didn't cite me under the correct statute. There's a different statute that has different notice requirements. They obviously recognized that because after she physically departed the state, and that's a key fact here that was not disputed in the court below, that she just departed the state in August of 07, they filed their amended notice giving her the appropriate notice of the 20 days in September of 07, and that's not disputed. In fact, I'm going to talk about the facts just a little bit here. But the point is that actually, if you want to carve out an exception to this notice, very specific notice requirements of the statute, which involve putting the state of Nevada on notice because the state of Nevada has an interest in protecting its citizens. In other words, if somebody wants to reduce child support, and let's say the person here is on public support and getting, you know, welfare benefits, the state has an interest in that procedure, and that's why there was a notice requirement in the state, which, again, they didn't do. So, and this is a Uniform Act, Judge. This is not something that was cooked up by the Nevada legislature. This is a Uniform Act, and there are reasons to have these notice requirements. I don't think that it is good policy from any stretch of the imagination to simply carve out an actual notice exception to the otherwise mandatory requirements of notice in this case, because it conferred valuable rights on Amy to contest this before she had to spend money for attorney's fees contesting the merits of this case. I want to talk about the actual facts that the judge relied on to make his decision that there was no jurisdiction. As we all know, physical presence by itself does not establish personal jurisdiction. This statute, Chapter 130, the correct statute, specifically invokes the jurisdiction of a new court here in Nevada only if there's a personal if the court has personal jurisdiction over the non-registering party. It's right in the statute I quoted to. Personal jurisdiction in this state, if based on residency, has always meant both physical presence or domicile plus intent. You could argue that she tried to do, through some artifice, escape Nevada and deny that she was a lawful resident to defeat his petition. You could argue that, except for one salient point, and that is in March of 07, before the Nevada court system was even a gleam in Mr. Simon's eye, her attorneys in California had sent to his attorneys in California, where the order comes from, or the order comes from, a unfiled motion to modify the custody in California. And they had attached to that, and that was part of the record below, her declaration signed under oath in March of 07 that she intended to move back to California, that she couldn't make it in Nevada anymore. There were lots of things going on with Mr. Simon and his divorce in California. And again, Mr. Willick makes representations about his residency. None of that was ever really presented to the court below. What we do know is that at the time that he initiated this petition here in Nevada, he was enmeshed in a very contentious and expensive divorce case in Los Angeles County in California, where he was getting divorced from his long-term wife. So whether he was a California resident, New Jersey, New York, doesn't really make any difference. The point is that she had already declared her intention to return to California and institute a procedures there to modify the existing support order. It was Mr. Simon who tried to do an end run here. After getting that notice and saying, gee, I'm going to be fighting about child support again with this woman. I'm fighting another battle in divorce court here in California. Maybe I can get a better shake in Nevada under the Nevada court system, who have a reputation, at least in his mind, or some people's minds, of not being as generous with regard to child support as they are in California. And there's no question about it. The child support, which he agreed to for this child, for Kylie, is significant. It is a lot of money. And he might have a better chance convincing a Nevada judge, I guess, that he should pay less child support. But that's not the point. The point is that he was on notice of her intent to relocate to California, sell her house here at the time that he filed this petition. It is a factual question as to two significant times that I think militate in favor of the judge's decision in this case. When she was initially defectively served, or served with a defective notice, she was still physically present in this state, but had declared her intention, uncontradicted in the court below, that she was moving back to California. This is not artifice on her part. This is something that had been done months earlier. Number two, by the time they filed their amended notice, giving her the statutorily mandated notice requirements, the 20 days and so on, that was in September of 07. She had already physically departed the state. She had moved back to California with Kylie, enrolled her in school, had applied to reinstate her California driver's license, which she showed the judge in the court below, and had left the state. So it wasn't like she was splitting after she was properly hauled before the court in Nevada. She wasn't even technically before the court in Nevada, pursuant to a valid Chapter 130, actually still not valid to this day. They've never cited Chapter 130 as the jurisdictional basis for the court to act. They have maintained this, as I said, showed you the statute there, that the Chapter 125 has anything to do with this. And again, you ask a good question, Justice Gibbons. I mean, didn't she have actual notice? Yes, she had actual notice. But is a good public policy for this court to say, well, in interpreting a uniform act, we're going to dispense with certain notice requirements if there's actual notice? I don't think that that's good public policy for the state. I think that there are reasons, good reasons, for these notice requirements, and that they can't be waived, and they shouldn't be ignored by the court below or this court. And when you think about the bottom line on this case, you know, what is the consequence of this court affirming the lower court? The consequence is that they're both he has attorneys in California, she has attorneys in California, she and the child live in California, he may or may not live in California. The California has the original order. They, you know, why should we impose on Nevada district courts the obligation to resolve child custody determinations when people don't even live here anymore? And the key fact here is that she didn't live here at the time that they did their amended notice. It's still defective. Our position is it's still defective because they never relied on the correct statute. And that's important. But equally important is the fact that at the time that they did the amended notice, still under Chapter 125, she had left the state. And it cannot relate back. You can't say that just because somebody is physically present here, that automatically means that they're residents of the state. If that was the law, then anybody that stepped off a plane at McCarran Airport could be subject to process in this state because they're physically present here. When she had declared with no agenda, other than the fact I'm leaving Nevada and I'm coming back to California, when she declared that under oath in March of 07, she could, and they had the right to contest that in the court below. Had they wanted to make an issue out of her residency, they could have done that, but they didn't. They simply said, since she was here when we started this process under this case, I guess, even though it hadn't come down, it wasn't decided, you know, it was decided in February, it was unpublished, that's sufficient to invest this court with jurisdiction. And that throws away all of the procedural safeguards that Amy and other women, or men too, I guess for that matter, have to not subject them to the jurisdiction of another state unless there is a jurisdictional basis for that. And if you look at the facts as recited in this case, this unpublished case, it's clear that there was a major factual difference between the facts of that case.
Mr. Wells, I can tell you, Mr. Wilk, we're not going to rely on the other case. I mean, you can argue it persuasively or we should do something, but we can't do it.
Well,
it's not an opinion, you know. So.
Okay. The only persuasive part of this case, I think, because the facts are different in terms of when that person left the state and when she got served properly, because there was no indication in this opinion there was improper registration. The important part about this is that the court recites in this order that you need to do this under Chapter 130. You can't simply adopt another statute, 125, and say that suffices. There's no case law that says that. The whole thrust, I think, of the appellant's position is that because she was on actual notice, because she was physically present here, that's sufficient. But that isn't sufficient. It shouldn't be sufficient. And let me just, since I think the facts and the law are on the side of the respondent in this case, let me, if I may, presume to give you a couple public policy considerations for a case like this. I don't see any public interest in enforcing Nevada courts to wrestle with California support orders in terms of modification. Obviously, the court has the power to do that if it properly has the jurisdiction to do that, and if there's no other basis. Mr. Woolick said, well, there was no other state that had jurisdiction at the time that this petition was filed. That's not true. Once Amy went on record as saying she's moving back to California, California clearly had jurisdiction, and I think California retained jurisdiction until another court would take that jurisdiction pursuant to a valid registration. That's what the statute says. Once this court has valid jurisdiction and issues an order, then this court retains that exclusive jurisdiction until it's taken away by another forum at some time in the future. Well, that hadn't happened. So it's not true that Mr. Simon was without a remedy. He was still litigating a California divorce. I don't know. I don't know how it would have been impossible or why he wouldn't have simply said, I've got a child here. I've got a child support order here. I want the court to modify it. Clearly, they could have done that. But he chose to come to Nevada, I think, trying to get a better break. I don't think from a public policy standpoint, and I'm almost done here, that it serves any purpose for us to advertise Nevada as a child support haven. That's really what's going on here. I mean, we cut to the chase. I think that's not good for the public image of the state to say that we're going to carve out exceptions to a uniform act so that people can rush over here and get a Nevada judge, presumably to reduce child support from another jurisdiction. And the remedy that Mr. Simon has, if this court affirms the district court, is he simply files a motion in California. Amy's there, the child's there, his attorneys are there, her attorneys are there. Why subject Nevada courts to the time and expense of applying California law, which is what the statute seems to suggest, is that the Nevada district judge has to interpret California support law to make a ruling in Nevada. It doesn't make sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. Mr. Willick, your rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I waited for Mr. Wells to actually read you the registration provision of Chapter 130. He didn't, because as of the date of the hearing of this matter, which is when the applicable law was in question, it said, file the foreign support order with the district court, which is exactly what we did. As of the date of the hearing, we did exactly what the statute said you're supposed to do, the prior defective statute having been modified. So that whole nonsense about 125A versus 130 is nonsense. It simply has no application here. as to 611, the notices in question are set out verbatim on page 12 of our brief. It says, we have filed a child support case. You have a chance to oppose it. The next one says, you have 20 days to oppose it. And if they had chosen to oppose it, they had three possible grounds to oppose the registration. One, that the original court didn't have jurisdiction. Well, they're not going to argue that. She's the one who filed in California originally. Two, that it's invalid because it had been set aside. Nobody's ever even suggested that's possible. Or three, that the person objecting had no notice of the original proceedings, meaning the California proceedings. She filed the California proceedings. So, yeah, she had 20 days to file an objection. The three bases on which she might have filed an objection are all not true. They know it's not true. They had no basis to file anything. That's why they never have. They've never attempted to say that the registration's improper because the registration is not improper. They have no legitimate basis for objection. The forms in use today in the family courts of at least Southern Nevada, and I think the Supreme Court's forms as well, say if you have a foreign custody and or support order, file this form. The form says that today. They are still giving everybody notice under 125A because that's the standard form in use. It's been approved by this court. That's the form of notice that's going to everybody. And Mr. Simon is no less eligible to give notice under that general registration provision than the people using the self-help forms. In short, if there is any kind of an error in the form of registration, and we don't concede that there is, it's harmless error. And notice has nothing to do with jurisdiction. They simply can't get around the fact a petitioner may commence a proceeding by filing a petition in a tribunal which can obtain personal jurisdiction over a respondent. Yes, if she steps off a plane at McCarran, and if there is a proceeding in Nevada where she can be served, she can be served. And the decisions of this court for the last 100 years have said that if you serve somebody in the state of Nevada, you've got jurisdiction over them. That's what our statutes say. That's what they've always said. He can't get around it by saying, Gus, well, I'm not really here. Because in my mind, I'm on a beach in California.
What about the public policy argument that Mr. Wells made, though, about why should our courts be involved in this?
Because it's under Nevada law. He's just dead wrong in that regard. If this case proceeds here, it applies Nevada procedural law, Nevada substantive law, Nevada child support law. The California law is totally irrelevant, which is exactly why they don't want it heard here. Because California has an absurd child support statute, which says that basically if the payor is rich enough, it doesn't make any difference about anything. They escalate forever. In this case, she's getting $15,000 a month, basically in blackmail money, which is what she negotiated to try to keep the case quiet after she turned up pregnant. She doesn't want the child support order to be amended to anything actually having anything to do with support of the child. That's what's really going on here. Because she wants $500,000. That affidavit he was talking about, that she executed in California, it says on its face, I live in Nevada. Which is why he filed in Nevada, to modify the child support order. It says, I may move back to California, and I want $500,000 a year because someday when I move back to California, the cost of living is going to be higher. And I just can't make it on $15,000 a month in child support. That's what her affidavit said. But she admitted she was living in Nevada. And that's all that UWISA is concerned with. The public policy is that once somebody is, once a child support modification motion is filed where somebody lives, that's the court that hears the case, using the law of the place in question. Both parties required to file an away game. That's what the statute says. And he can pretend it says something else, but it doesn't. That is as simple as it gets. Jurisdiction, let's see, the time to measure jurisdiction is the time of filing of a proceeding to modify the child support order. I don't know how much clearer that can get, and that's U.S. official comment to Section 205. Which has been adopted in Nevada, first in 1997 and then in amended form in 2007. It's a straight matter of law. As to any technical deficiency, for 140 years, the cases of this court have said that everything relates back. If I file a defective affidavit, if I file a defective notice, and that defect is noticed during the course of the proceedings, I can fix it at any time. That's been the law here since 1867. Again, he doesn't address those cases, but he can't ignore them out of existence. The face of UWISA says that the state where the child support modification motion is filed should resolve it. And that really is the end of this case. There really isn't any more to it, except that the reason we need a published opinion is that people keep trying to get away with this. They keep trying to flee the state.
And Mr. Willick, maybe if the Justice Turian say his permission, I can comment on the published opinion. Generally, the panel doesn't do opinions. Well, on rare occasions, we will. But the idea is that let the en banc court do the episode, seven people speaking versus three. Whatever we do on this case, you know, let's say we resolve the case by an order. I mean, either side can ask to the en banc court for reconsider and to publish. I mean, you can't. I mean, it's your option under the rules of appellate procedure. But I just want you to know generally it's an uphill battle to get a panel to do an opinion. But Justice Cherry's presiding, and he can create some exceptions.
I would ask this court to look at the public policy. If I get three of these cases inside of 6 months, where defendants, having been served with modification motions, scoot out of state to try to defeat the jurisdiction of the court, I'm only one law office. I know that the problem is more widespread than that, just from anecdotal evidence from my own observation. So I would ask the panel to consider.
Well, I know that Justice Sada, Justice Gibbons, and myself are very concerned about that maybe over the years we've ignored the family practitioners a little bit. So we're trying. I know with Rivero, we spent a lot of time on that to try to make sure that we were doing the right thing for the whole jurisdiction, the jurisprudence in that area. So I'm glad both of you brought this to our attention.
I'd gladly answer any questions the court might have as to any of the matters raised by my opponent.
I have no questions, Justice Gibbons, Justice Sada. Thank you both. both of you lived up to your expectations, by the way, and we thank you for your expertise, and also we thank you for your civility to this argument.